and screaming if need be, to the safety of the station. Perhaps, here in the open air, it could not use its stench defense as effectively as it had in the confines of the station, and that, he thought, might make it easier. He examined the clump of boulders from one edge to the other, and there was nothing that might help him to locate the alien. Slowly, he began to snake around, getting ready for the next rush up the slope, moving carefully so that no sound would betray him. Out of the tail of his eye, he caught the moving shadow that came flowing up the slope. Swiftly, he sat up, swinging the rifle. But before he could bring the muzzle round, the shadow was upon him, bearing him back, flat upon the ground, with one great splay-fingered hand clamped upon his mouth.
"Ulysses!"
Enoch gurgled, but the fearsome shape only hissed at him in a warning sound. Slowly, the weight shifted off him, and the hand slid from his mouth. Ulysses gestured toward the boulder pile, and Enoch nodded. Ulysses crept closer and lowered his head toward Enoch's. He whispered with his mouth inches from the Earthman's ear. "The talisman. He has the talisman."
"The talisman!"
Enoch cried aloud, trying to strangle off the cry even as he made it, remembering that he should make no sound to let the watcher up above know where they might be. From the ridge above, a loose stone rattled as it was dislodged and began to roll, bouncing down the slope. Enoch hunkered closer to the ground behind the fallen log.
"Down!" he shouted to Ulysses. "Down! He has a gun!"
But Ulysses' hand gripped him by the shoulder.
"Enoch!" he cried. "Enoch, look!"
Enoch jerked himself erect, and atop the pile of rock, dark against the skyline, were two grappling figures.
"Lucy!"
he shouted. For one of them was Lucy, and the other was the alien. She sneaked up on him, he thought. The damn little fool. She sneaked up on him. While the alien had been distracted with watching the slope, she had slipped up close and then had tackled him. She had a club of some sort in her hand, an old dead branch, perhaps, and it was raised above her head, ready for a stroke, but the alien had a grip upon her arm, and she could not strike.
"Shoot,"
said Ulysses, in a flat, dead voice. Enoch raised the rifle and had trouble with the sights because of the deepening darkness, and they were so close together. They were too close together.
"Shoot!" yelled Ulysses.
"I can't!" sobbed Enoch. "It's too dark to shoot!"
"You have to shoot," Ulysses said, his voice tense and hard. "You have to take the chance."
Enoch raised the rifle once again, and the sights seemed clearer now, and he knew the trouble was not so much the darkness as that shot which he had missed back there in the world of the honking thing that had strode its world on stilts. If he had missed then, he could as well miss now. The bead came to rest upon the head of the rat-like creature, and then the head bobbed away, but was bobbing back again.
"Shoot!"
Ulysses yelled. Enoch squeezed the trigger, and the rifle coughed, and up atop of the rocks the creature stood for a second with only half a head, and with tattered gouts of flesh flying briefly like dark insects zooming against the half-light of the western sky. Enoch dropped the gun and sprawled upon the earth, clawing his fingers into the thin and mossy soil, sick with the thought of what could have happened, weak with the thankfulness that it had not happened, that the years on that fantastic rifle range had at last paid off. "How strange it is," he thought, "how so many senseless things shape our destiny." For the rifle range had been a senseless thing, as senseless as a billiard table or a game of cards, designed for one thing only: to please the keeper of the station. And yet the hours he'd spent there had shaped toward this hour and end, to this single instant on this restricted slope of ground. The sickness drained away into the earth beneath him, and a peace came stealing in upon him. The peace of trees and woodland soil, and the first faint hush of nightfall. As if the sky and stars and very space itself had leaned close above him and was whispering his essential oneness with them. And it seemed for a moment that he had grasped the edge of some great truth, and with this truth had come a comfort and a greatness he'd never known before.
"Enoch," Ulysses whispered. "Enoch, my brother." There was something like a hidden sob in the alien's voice, and he had never, until this moment, called the Earthman brother. Enoch pulled himself to his knees, and up on the pile of tumbled boulders was a soft and wondrous light, a soft and gentle light, as if a giant firefly had turned on its lamp and had not turned it off, but had left it burning. The light was moving down across the rocks toward them, and he could see Lucy moving with the light, as if she were walking toward them with a lantern in her hand. Ulysses' hand reached out of the darkness and closed hard on Enoch's arm.
"Do you see?" he asked.
"Yes, I see. What is..."
"It is the talisman," Ulysses said, enraptured, his breath rasping in his throat. "And she is our new custodian, the one we've hunted through the years."
Chapter 33. You did not become accustomed to it, Enoch told himself as they tramped up through the woods. There was not a moment you were not aware of it. It was something that you wanted to hug close against yourself and hold it there forever. And even when it was gone from you, you'd probably not forget it, ever. It was something that was past all description. A mother's love, a father's pride, the adoration of a sweetheart, the closeness of a comrade. It was all of these and more. It made the farthest distance near and turned the complex simple, and it swept away all fear and sorrow, for all of their being a certain feeling of deep sorrow in it, as if one might feel that never in his lifetime would he know an instant like this, and that in another instant he would lose it and never would be able to hunt it out again. But that was not the way it was, for this ascendant instant kept going on and on. Lucy walked between them, and she held the bag that contained the talisman close against her breast, with her two arms clasped about it. And Enoch, looking at her, in the soft glow of its light, could not help but think of a little girl carrying her beloved pussycat.
"Never for a century," said Ulysses, "perhaps for many centuries, perhaps never, has it glowed so well. I myself cannot remember when it was like this. It is wonderful, is it not?" "Yes," said Enoch, "it is wonderful." "Now we shall be one again," Ulysses said. "Now we shall feel again. Now we shall be a people instead of many people."
"But the creature that had it?"
"A clever one," Ulysses said. "He was holding it for ransom."
"It had been stolen then?"
"We do not know all the circumstances," Ulysses told him. "We will find out, of course."
They tramped on in silence through the woods, and far in the east one could see, through the treetops, the first flush in the sky that foretold the rising moon.
"There is something," Enoch said.
"Ask me," said Ulysses.
"How could that creature back there carry it and not feel no part of it? For if he could have, he would not have stolen it."
"There is only one in many billions," Ulysses said, "who can, how do you say it, tune in on it, perhaps. To you and I, it would be nothing. It would not respond to us. We could hold it in our hands forever, and there would nothing happen. But let that one in many billions lay a finger on it, and it becomes alive. There is a certain rapport, a sensitivity, I don't know how to say it, that forms a bridge between this strange machine and the cosmic spiritual force. It is not the machine itself, you understand, that reaches out and taps the spiritual force. It is the living creature's mind, aided by the mechanism, that brings the force to us."
A machine, a mechanism, no more than a tool, technological brother to the hoe, the wrench, the hammer, and yet as far a cry from these as the human brain was from that first amino acid which had come into being on this planet when the Earth was very young. One was tempted, Enoch thought, to say that this was as far as a tool could go, that it was the ultimate in the ingenuity possessed by any brain. But that would be a dangerous way of thinking, for perhaps there was no limit. There might, quite likely, be no such condition as the ultimate.
There might be no time when any creature or any group of creatures could stop at any certain point and say, "This is as far as we can go." There is no use of trying to go farther. For each new development produced, as side effects, so many other possibilities, so many other roads to travel, that with each step one took down any given road, there were more paths to follow. There'd never be an end, he thought. No end to anything. They reached the edge of the field and headed up across it toward the station. From its upper edge came the sound of running feet.
"Enoch!"
a voice shouted out of the darkness.
"Enoch, is that you?"
Enoch recognized the voice.
"Yes, Winslow. What is wrong?"
The mailman burst out of the darkness and stopped, panting with his running, at the edge of light.
"Enoch, they are coming! A couple of carloads of them, but I put a crimp in them. Where the road turns off into your lane, that narrow place, you know, I dumped 2 pounds of roofing nails along the ruts. That'll hold them for a while."
"Roofing nails?" Ulysses asked.
"It's a mob," Enoch told him. "They are after me. The nails..."
"Oh, I see," Ulysses said. "The deflation of the tires."
Winslow took a slow step closer, his gaze riveted on the glow of the shielded talisman.
"That's Lucy Fisher, ain't it?"
"Of course it is," said Enoch.
"Her old man came roaring into town just a while ago and said she was gone again. Up until then, everything had quieted down and it was all right, but old Hank, he got them stirred up again. So I went down to the hardware store and got them roofing nails, and I beat them here."
"This mob?" Ulysses asked.
"I don't..." Winslow interrupted him, gasping in his eagerness to tell all his information.
"That ginseng man is up there, waiting at the house for you. He has a panel truck."
"That," said Enoch, "would be Lewis with the hazer's body."
"He is some upset," said Winslow. "He said you were expecting him."
"Perhaps," suggested Ulysses. "We shouldn't just be standing here. It seems to my poor intellect that many things indeed may be coming to a crisis."
"Say," the mailman yelled, "what is going on here? What is that thing Lucy has, and who's this fellow with you?"
"Later," Enoch told him. "I'll tell you later. There's no time to tell you now."
"But, Enoch, there's the mob."
"I'll deal with them," said Enoch grimly, "when I have to deal with them. Right now, there's something more important."
They ran up the slope, the four of them, dodging through the waist-high clumps of weeds. Ahead of them, the station reared dark and angular against the evening sky.
"They're down there at the turnoff,"
Winslow gasped, wheezing with his running.
"That flash of light down the ridge, that was the headlights of a car."
They reached the edge of the yard and ran toward the house. The black bulk of the panel truck glimmered in the glow cast by the talisman. A figure detached itself from the shadow of the truck and hurried out toward them.
"Is that you, Wallace?"
"Yes," said Enoch. "I'm sorry that I wasn't here."
"I was a bit upset," said Lewis, "when I didn't find you waiting."
"Something unforeseen," said Enoch. "Something that must be taken care of."
"The body of the Honored One?" Ulysses asked. "It is in the truck?"
Lewis nodded.
"I am happy that we can restore it."
"We'll have to carry him down to the orchard," Enoch said. "You can't get a car in there."
"The other time," Ulysses said, "you were the one who carried him."
Enoch nodded.
"My friend," the alien said, "I wonder if on this occasion I could be allowed the honor."
"Why, yes, of course," said Enoch. "He would like it that way." And the words came to his tongue, but he choked them back, for it would not have done to say them. The words of thanks for lifting from him the necessity of complete recompense, for the gesture which released him from the utter letter of the law. At his elbow, Winslow said,
"They are coming! I can hear them down the road!"
He was right. From down the road came the soft sound of footsteps padding in the dust, not hurrying, with no need to hurry, the insulting and deliberate treading of a monster so certain of its prey that it need not hurry. Enoch swung around and half-lifted his rifle, training it toward the padding that came out of the dark. Behind him, Ulysses spoke softly.
Perhaps it would be most proper to bear him to the grave in the full glory and unshielded light of our restored talisman.
She can't hear you, Enoch said. You must remember, she is deaf. You will have to show her.
But even as he said it, a blaze leaped out that was blinding in its brightness. With a strangled cry, Enoch half turned back to face the little group that stood beside the truck, and the bag that had enclosed the talisman, he saw, lay at Lucy's feet, and she held the glowing brightness high and proudly so that it spread its light across the yard and the ancient house, and some of it as well spilled out into the field. There was a quietness, as if the entire world had caught its breath and stood attentive and in awe, waiting for a sound that did not come, that would never come, but would always be expected. And with the quietness came an abiding sense of peace that seemed to seep into the very fiber of one's being. It was no synthetic thing, not as if someone had invoked a peace and peace then was allowed to exist by sufferance. It was a present and an actual peace, the peace of mind that came with the calmness of a sunset after a long, hot day, or the sparkling, ghost-like shimmer of a springtime dawn. You felt it inside of you and all about you, and there was the feeling that it was not only here, but that the peace extended on and out in all directions to the farthest reaches of infinity, and that it had a depth which would enable it to endure until the final gasp of all eternity. Slowly, remembering, Enoch turned back to face the field, and the men were there, at the edge of the light cast by the talisman, a gray, huddled group, like a pack of chastened wolves that slunk at the faint periphery of a campfire's light. And as he watched, they melted back into the deeper dark from which they had padded in the dust track of the road. Except for one, who turned and bolted, plunging down the hill in the darkness toward the woods, howling in maddened terror like a frightened dog.
"There goes Hank," said Winslow. "That is Hank running down the hill."
"I am sorry that we frightened him," said Enoch soberly. "No man should be afraid of this."
"It is himself that he is frightened of," the mailman said. "He lives with a terror in him."
And that was true, thought Enoch. That was the way with man. It had always been that way. He had carried terror with him, and the thing he was afraid of had always been himself.
Chapter 34. The grave was filled and mounded, and the five of them stood for a moment more, listening to the restless wind that stirred in the moon-drenched apple orchard, while from far away, down in the hollows above the river valley, the whippoorwills talked back and forth through the silver night. In the moonlight, Enoch tried to read the graven line upon the rough-hewn tombstone, but there was not light enough. Although there was no need to read it, it was in his mind. "Here lies one from a distant star, but the soil is not alien to him, for in death he belongs to the universe." When you wrote that, the Hazer diplomat had told him, just the night before, "You wrote as one of us." And he had not said so, but the Vegan had been wrong, for it was not a Vegan's sentiment alone. It was human, too. The words were chiseled awkwardly, and there was a mistake or two in spelling, for the Hazer language was not an easy one to master. The stone was softer than the marble or the granite most commonly used for gravestones, and the lettering would not last. In a few more years, the weathering of sun and rain and frost would blur the characters, and in some years after that, they would be entirely gone, with no more than the roughness of the stone remaining to show that words had once been written there. But it did not matter, Enoch thought, for the words were graven on more than stone alone. He looked across the grave at Lucy. The talisman was in its bag once more, and the glow was softer. She still held it clasped tight against herself, and her face was still exalted and unnoticing, as if she no longer lived in the present world, but had entered into some other place, some other far dimension where she dwelled alone and was forgetful of all past.
"Do you think," Ulysses asked, "that she will go with us? Do you think that we can have her? Will the earth?"
"The earth," said Enoch, "has not a thing to say.
We Earth people are free agents. It is up to her.
You think that she will go?
I think so, Enix said. I think maybe this has been the moment she had sought for all her life. I wonder if she might not have sensed it, even with no talisman.
For she always had been in touch with something outside of human ken. She had something in her no other human had. You sensed it, but you could not name it, for there was no name for this thing she had, and she had fumbled with it, trying to use it, not knowing how to use it, charming off the warts and healing poor hurt butterflies, and only God knew what other acts that she performed unseen.
Her parent? Ulysses asked. The howling one that ran away from us?
I'll handle him, said Lewis. I'll have a talk with him. I know him fairly well.
You want her to go back with you to Galactic Central? Enix asked. If she will, Ulysses said. Central must be told at once.
And from there, throughout the galaxy?
Yes, Ulysses said. We need her very badly.
Could we, I wonder, borrow her for a day or two?
Borrow her?
Yes, said Enix. For we need her, too. We need her worst of all.
Of course, Ulysses said. But I don't...
Lewis, Enix asked, do you think our government, the Secretary of State, perhaps, might be persuaded to appoint one Lucy Fisher as a member of our peace conference delegation? Lewis stammered, made a full stop, then began again. I think it could possibly be managed.
Can you imagine, Enix asked, the impact of this girl and the talisman at the conference table?
I think I can, said Lewis. But the secretary undoubtedly would want to talk with you before he arrived at his decision.
Enix half turned toward Ulysses, but he did not need to phrase his question.
By all means, Ulysses said to Lewis, let me know, and I'll sit in on the meeting. And you might tell the good secretary, too, that it would not be a bad idea to begin the formation of a world committee.
A world committee?
To arrange, Ulysses said, for the Earth becoming one of us. We cannot accept a custodian, can we, from an outside planet?
Chapter 35. In the moonlight, the tumbled boulder pile gleamed whitely, like the skeleton of some prehistoric beast. For here, near the edge of the cliff that towered above the river, the heavy trees thinned out, and the rocky point stood open to the sky. Enix stood beside one of the massive boulders and gazed down at the huddled figure that lay among the rocks. Poor, tattered bungler, he thought, dead so far from home, and so far as he, himself, must be concerned, to so little purpose. Although perhaps neither poor nor tattered, for in that brain, now broken and splattered beyond recovery, must surely have lain a scheme of greatness, the kind of scheme that the brain of an earthly Alexander or Xerxes or Napoleon may have held, a dream of some great power, cynically conceived, to be attained and held at whatever cost, the dimensions of it so grandiose that it shoved aside and canceled out all moral considerations. He tried momentarily to imagine what the scheme might be, but knew, even as he tested his imagination, how foolish it was to try. For there would be factors, he was sure, that he would not recognize, and considerations that might lie beyond his understanding. But however that might be, something had gone wrong. For in the plan itself, Earth could have had no place other than as a hideout which could be used if trouble struck. This creature's lying here, then, was a part of desperation, a last-ditch gamble that had not worked out. And, Enix thought, it was ironic that the key of failure lay in the fact that the creature, in its fleeing, had carried the talisman into the backyard of a sensitive, and on a planet, too, where no one would have thought to look for a sensitive. For, thinking back on it, there could be little doubt that Lucy had sensed the talisman and had been drawn to it as truly as a magnet would attract a piece of steel. She had known nothing else, perhaps, than that the talisman had been there and was something she must have, that it was something she had waited for in all her loneliness, without knowing what it was or without hope of finding it.
like a child who sees, quite suddenly, a shiny, glorious bauble on a Christmas tree and knows that it's the grandest thing on earth and that it must be hers. This creature lying here, thought Enoch, must have been able and resourceful, for it would have taken great ability and resourcefulness to have stolen the talisman to start with, to keep it hidden for years, to have penetrated into the secrets and the files of Galactic Central. Would it have been possible, he wondered, if the talisman had been in effective operation? With an energetic talisman, would the moral laxity and the driving greed been possible to motivate the deed? But that was ended now. The talisman had been restored, and a new custodian had been found. A deaf-mute girl of Earth, the humblest of humans. And there would be peace on Earth, and in time the Earth would join the co-fraternity of the galaxy. There were no problems now, he thought, no decisions to be made. Lucy had taken the decisions from the hands of everyone. The station would remain, and he could unpack the boxes he had packed and put the journals back on the shelves again. He could go back to the station once again and settle down and carry on his work. I am sorry, he told the huddled shape that lay among the boulders. I am sorry that mine was the hand that had to do it to you. He turned away and walked out to where the cliff dropped straight down to the river flowing at its foot. He raised the rifle and held it for a moment motionless, and then he threw it out and watched it fall, spinning end for end, the moonlight glinting off the barrel, saw the tiny splash it made as it struck the water, and far below he heard the smug, contented gurgling of the water as it flowed past this cliff and went on to the further ends of the earth. There would be peace on Earth, he thought. There would be no war. With Lucy at the conference table, there could be no thought of war. Even if some ran howling from the fear inside themselves, a fear and guilt so great that it overrode the glory and the comfort of the talisman, there still could be no war. But it was a long trail yet, a long, lonesome way before the brightness of real peace would live in the hearts of man. Until no man ran howling, wild with fear, any kind of fear, would there be actual peace. Until the last man threw away his weapon, any sort of weapon, the tribe of man could not be at peace. And a rifle, Enoch told himself, was the least of the weapons of the earth, the least of man's inhumanity to man, no more than a symbol of all the other and more deadly weapons. He stood on the rim of the cliff and looked out across the river and the dark shadow of the wooded valley. His hands felt strangely empty with the rifle gone, but it seemed that somewhere, back there just away, he had stepped into another field of time, as if an age or day had dropped away, and he had come into a place that was shining and brand new and unsullied by any past mistakes. The river rolled below him, and the river did not care. Nothing mattered to the river. It would take the tusk of Mastodon, the skull of Sabretooth, the ribcage of a man, the dead and sunken tree, the thrown rock or rifle, and would swallow each of them, and cover them in mud or sand and roll gurgling over them, hiding them from sight. 1,000,000 years ago there had been no river here, and in 1,000,000 years to come there might be no river. But in 1,000,000 years from now there would be, if not man, at least a caring thing. And that was the secret of the universe, Enoch told himself, a thing that went on caring. He turned slowly from the cliff edge and clambered through the boulders to go walking up the hill. He heard the tiny scurrying of small life rustling through the fallen leaves, and once there was the sleepy peeping of an awakened bird, and through the entire woods lay the peace and comfort of that glowing light. Not so intense, not so deep and bright and so wonderful as when it actually had been there, but a breath of it still left. He came to the edge of the woods and climbed the field, and ahead of him the station stood four square upon its ridgetop. And it seemed that it was no longer a station only, but his home as well. Many years ago it had been a home and nothing more, and then it had become a way station to the galaxy. But now, although way station still, it was home again. Chapter 36.
He came into the station, and the place was quiet, and just a little ghostly in the quietness of it. A lamp burned on his desk, and over on the coffee table the little pyramid of spheres was flashing, throwing its many colored lights, like the crystal balls they'd used in the Roaring Twenties to turn a dance hall into a place of magic. The tiny flickering colors went flitting all about the room, like the dance of a zany band of technicolor fireflies. He stood for a moment, indecisive, not knowing what to do. There was something missing, and all at once he realized what it was. During all the years there'd been a rifle to hang upon its pegs or to lay across the desk, and now there was no rifle. He'd have to settle down, he told himself, and get back to work. He'd have to unpack and put the stuff away. He'd have to get the journals written and catch up with his reading. There was a lot to do. Ulysses and Lucy had left an hour or two before, bound for Galactic Central, but the feeling of the talisman still seemed to linger in the room. Although perhaps, he thought, not in the room at all, but inside himself. Perhaps it was a feeling that he'd carry with him no matter where he went. He walked slowly across the room and sat down on the sofa. In front of him, the pyramid of spheres was splashing out its crystal shower of colors. He reached out a hand to pick it up, then drew it slowly back. What was the use, he asked himself, of examining it again? If he had not learned its secret the many times before, why should he expect to now? A pretty thing, he thought, but useless. He wondered how Lucy might be getting on, and knew she was all right. She'd get along, he told himself, anywhere she went. Instead of sitting here, he should be getting back to work. There was a lot of catching up to do, and his time would not be his own from now on, for the Earth would be pounding at the door. There would be conferences and meetings and a lot of other things, and in a few hours more the newspapers might be here. But before it happened, Ulysses would be back to help him, and perhaps there would be others too. In just a little while he'd rustle up some food, and then he'd get to work. If he worked far into the night, he could get a good deal done. Lonely nights, he told himself, were good for work. And it was lonely now, when it should not be lonely. For he no longer was alone, as he had thought he was alone just a few short hours before. Now he had the Earth and the galaxy, Lucy and Ulysses, Winslow and Lewis, and the old philosopher out in the apple orchard. He rose and walked to the desk and picked up the statuette Winslow had carved of him. He held it beneath the desk lamp and turned it slowly in his hands. There was, he saw now, a loneliness in that figure, too. The essential loneliness of a man who walked alone. But he'd had to walk alone. There'd been no other way. There had been no choice. It had been a one-man job, and now the job was, no, not done, for there still was much that must be done. But the first phase of it now was over, and the second phase was starting. He set the statuette back on the desk and remembered that he had not given Winslow the piece of wood the Thuban traveler had brought. Now he could tell Winslow where all the wood had come from. They could go through the journals and find the dates and the origin of every stick of it. That would please old Winslow. He heard the silken rustle and swung swiftly around.
"Mary!" he cried.
She stood just at the edge of shadow, and the flitting colors from the flashing pyramid made her seem like someone who had stepped from fairyland. And that was right, he was thinking wildly, for his lost fairyland was back.
"I had to come," she said. "You were lonely, Enoch, and I could not stay away."
She could not stay away, and that might be true, he thought, for within the conditioning he'd set up, there might have been the inescapable compulsion to come whenever she was needed. It was a trap, he thought, from which neither could escape. There was no free will here, but instead the deadly precision of this blind mechanism he had shaped himself. She should not come to see him, and perhaps she knew this as well as he, but could not help herself. Would this be, he wondered, the way it would be forever and ever? He stood there, frozen, torn by the need of her and the emptiness of her unreality, and she was moving toward him. She was close to him. and in a moment she would stop, for she knew the rules as well as he. She, no more than he, could admit illusion. But she did not stop. She came so close that he could smell the apple blossom fragrance of her. She put out a hand and laid it on his arm. It was no shadow touch, and it was no shadow hand. He could feel the pressure of her fingers and the coolness of them. He stood rigid, with her hand upon his arm. The flashing light, he thought. The pyramid of spheres. For now he remembered who had given it to him, one of those aberrant races of the Alphard system. And it had been from the literature of that system that he had learned the art of fairyland. They had tried to help him by giving him the pyramid, and he had not understood. There had been a failure of communication, but that was an easy thing to happen. In the babble of the galaxy, it was easy to misunderstand or simply not to know. For the pyramid of spheres was a wonderful and yet a simple mechanism. It was the fixation agent that banished all illusion, that made a fairyland for real. You made something as you wanted it and then turned on the pyramid, and you had what you had made, as real as if it had never been illusion. Except, he thought, in some things you couldn't fool yourself. You knew it was illusion, even if it should turn real. He reached out toward her tentatively, but her hand dropped from his arm, and she took a slow step backward. In the silence of the room, the terrible, lonely silence, they stood facing one another while the colored lights ran like playing mice as the pyramid of spheres twirled its everlasting rainbow.
"I am sorry," Mary said, "but it isn't any good. We can't fool ourselves."
He stood mute and shamed.
"I waited for it," she said. "I thought and dreamed about it."
"So did I," said Enoch. "I never thought that it would happen." And that was it, of course. So long as it could not happen, it was a thing to dream about. It was romantic and far off and impossible. Perhaps it had been romantic, only because it had been so far off and so impossible.
"As if a doll had come to life," she said. "Or a beloved teddy bear." "I am sorry, Enoch, but you could not love a doll or a teddy bear that had come to life. You always would remember them the way they were before. The doll with the silky painted smile, the teddy bear with the stuffing coming out of it."
"No!" cried Enoch. "No!"
"Poor Enoch," she said. "It will be so bad for you. I wish that I could help. You'll have so long to live with it."
"But you," he cried. "But you, what can you do now?"
It had been she, he thought, who had the courage. The courage that it took to face things as they were. How, he wondered, had she sensed it? How could she have known?
"I shall go away," she said. "I shall not come back. Even when you need me, I shall not come back. There is no other way."
"But you can't go away," he said. "You are trapped the same as I."
"Isn't it strange," she said, "how it happened to us, both of us victims of illusion?"
"But you," he said, "not you."
She nodded gravely.
"I, the same as you. You can't love the doll you made, or I, the toy maker. But each of us thought we did. Each of us still think we should, and are guilty and miserable when we find we can't."
"We could try," said Enoch. "If you would only stay."
"And end up by hating you? And worse than that, by your hating me. Let us keep the guilt and misery. It is better than the hate."
She moved swiftly, and the pyramid of spheres was in her hand and lifted.
"No, not that," he shouted. "No, Mary!"
The pyramid flashed, spinning in the air, and crashed against the fireplace. The flashing lights went out. Something, glass, metal, stone, tinkled on the floor.
"Mary!"
Enoch cried, striding forward in the dark. But there was no one there.
"Mary!"
he shouted, and the shouting was a whimper. She was gone, and she would not be back.
Even when he needed her, she would not be back. He stood quietly in the dark and silence, and the voice of a century of living seemed to speak to him in a silent language. "All things are hard," it said. "There is nothing easy." There had been the farm girl living down the road, and the southern beauty who had watched him pass her gate, and now there was Mary, gone forever from him. He turned heavily in the room and moved forward, groping for the table. He found it, and switched on the light. He stood beside the table and looked about the room. In this corner where he stood, there once had been a kitchen. And there, where the fireplace stood, the living room. And it all had changed. It had been changed for a long time now. But he still could see it as if it were only yesterday. All the days were gone, and all the people in them. Only he was left. He had lost his world. He had left his world behind him. And likewise, on this day, had all the others, all the humans that were alive this moment. They might not know it yet, but they, too, had left their world behind them. It would never be the same again. You said goodbye to so many things, to so many loves, to so many dreams. "Goodbye, Mary," he said. "Forgive me, and God keep you." He sat down at the table and pulled the journal that lay upon its top in front of him. He flipped it open, searching for the pages he must fill. He had work to do. Now he was ready for it. He had said his last goodbye.
This has been an Audible Frontiers production. Executive producer Steve Feldberg. Supervising producer Mike Charzik. Producer Gail Hendricks. Music by Michael Whalen. Copyright 1963 by Clifford D. Simak. Audio recording copyright 2008 by Audible Inc.